This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Start your free trial today. Go to Squarespace.com and enter in offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first purchase. Hello, beautiful sweeties. It's me, Duncan, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And I'm sitting here in Hawaii at the Ram Dass Spring Retreat. And I was just in Oakland at the MAP Psychedelic Science Conference. So I'm a few moments away from just turning into a rainbow. I'm a few moments away from every atom in my body just flying away, leaving a kind of glitter pile in my stead. This is heavy-duty stuff, man. So you got to forgive me. This, whatever comes out of my mouth now, is what I'm going to upload. It's going to be rambly, maybe. It's going to sound a little new agey. And maybe in a few weeks, I'll look back at this intro and be mortified that I dared say what I'm about to say, because I know how it might sound. So you have to trust me, or not, when I say this, because I clearly I'm not a journalist. I didn't go to school to be a journalist. I don't even know what the definition of journalism is. But I can report to you my experiences. And I can report to you anecdotal evidence of certain things. And I could be completely wrong. I could just be a lunatic. I could be sliding in. I could be sliding into some ridiculous, naive paradigm, wishful thinking. You wish this were true. That's not true. Turn on the news. Go outside. Look what's happening. And part of me believes the horror story. Part of me gets off on the horror story from the news. Part of me gets off on it. It's the dark novelty that's approaching, you know? Whatever it may be, some new war, some environmental catastrophe, something like that. But another part of me, and a part of me that is beginning to become most of me, thinks that something is on the horizon that's pretty incredible. And after having spent the last few weeks hanging out with a variety of luminaries, awakened beings, psychonauts, spiritualists, meditators, disciplined people, entrepreneurs, and optimists, visionaries, channelers, I gotta say that I think there's something to look forward to that isn't being reported on the news. I don't think the news could report on it. I think the journalists that work for the news stations are all going to a specific type of theater, and they're reporting on a specific type of play, and it's making everybody think that that's the play that's going on, and they're making everybody think that that's all there is. But here's the essence of it. Again, you have to forgive me. It's going to be rambly and weird. I've been to a lot of great, I'm in a Ram Dass retreat. I always do this. I always get stammery. You know, it opens you up here. You get this incredible contact eye. But here's the essence of what I'm thinking. A bird in China, flies over a pig farm. The bird's infected. It's got some kind of new form of flu, some weird mutant flu. Bird shits in a pig's mouth. Pig gets infected with this weird flu. Farmer comes out. Pig shits on the farmer. Farmer gets the shit in his mouth and his ears. Farmer spreads the plague. We've heard this story a million times. Movies are there's at least 5 movies about this very thing. I love them. And it spreads. The lady at the airport touches the flight attendant. The flight attendant humps someone in Vegas who goes home and cries on her baby, and the baby goes to daycare, and daycare, it spreads and spreads, and now it's the stand, and everyone's dying and coughing up blood, and you're walking through subway tunnels fighting off wolves with your flashlight and coughing up blood, and it's just hell. But I want to throw something out there. What if the opposite of that is possible? What if it's possible that it's not a bird that flies over and shits in a pig's mouth, but what if it's possible that some vehicle of novelty, let's just call it that. I don't know what it is. Some vehicle of novelty. It could be something as insane as a UFO, or something as mundane as a simple epiphany that appears in the mind of someone as they're crossing the street, who realizes some very special thing. It could be the final phase of a long process that's been going on behind the scenes for a while, like the fermentation of wine. Who knows? But let's just say some version of that bird has flown through society and hasn't necessarily shit in a pig's mouth, but has maybe created a shift inside some people, you know? Maybe some people are starting to figure some stuff out. That's what I'm saying. And maybe the way they're figuring it out is pragmatic. It's not crazy. They're not gazing into crystals. They're not doing weird dances or, I don't know, summon channeling spirits. Or maybe they are. I don't know. But what if they're, just imagine this fantasy, that there's a kind of not disease that's secretly spreading through the land right now, but unease that's spreading through the land, the opposite of a disease, an ease. That there's some people who are figuring out ways to use plant medicines, psychoactive chemicals, advanced forms of therapy in conjunction with these psychoactive chemicals to relieve trauma in humans, to relieve depression, to relieve addiction, these maladies that have haunted our species for millennia. And then imagine on top of that, that there's not just these alchemists who are working on compounds or exploring compounds or investigating the effects of compounds that seem to produce radical healing in folks who ingest them, but there's also groups of people who are spreading refined versions of philosophical systems. You know, and this is like Ram Dass. These are the, you know, the spiritual teachers who have cultivated a kind of state of consciousness that they spread through the world in words, but not just words, through their presence, but not just their presence, through their art. And then imagine this, that those two worlds are kind of mixing together. It's pretty cool to think about, right? So that what's happening is, instead of some rotten disease spreading through the land, the thing that everyone's like, ah, you mean the pipe dream of the 60s, the age of Aquarius bullshit? Yeah, that, but for real this time. That while you turn on the news and you see these weirdos in suits planning wars and various forms of decimating people, stealing their stuff, behind the scenes, there's the opposite of that. Groups of people working together, individuals working alone, networks of people who are working together because they have been not infected, but defected. They've defected from the paradigm. They've defected from the reality tunnel. that these corporatist lunatics are trying to suck us all into. There's a lot of defectors out there right now, friends. They're defecting from a world of pain, suffering, and greed, and pessimism, and cynicism. And that's called being healed, really. Being healed, you've defected. That's what it is. You've defected from the infection of fear that a lot of different weirdos want to inject into our brains with their dirty little corporate proboscis. So I'm very optimistic right now. Really am. At this very moment, I guarantee it. This very moment, somewhere, there's a room full of people drinking ayahuasca in some secret place in some city somewhere, entering into an alternate reality and being healed. There's people who are covertly administering MDMA to vets who have trauma. There's psychotherapists injecting ketamine into depressed people and really healing them. And I can tell you right now, just because I was just at it, there's rooms full of people singing kirtans, and chanting, and swaying to these ancient sounds that represent calling out to the force of love in the universe. And I'm pretty sure there's other things going on too that I have no idea about that would probably melt my brain if I were to see them. Hopefully I'll get invited to those events eventually too. So, don't be bummed out. Don't catch the wolf blitzer croup. Don't be blitzered or O'Reilly'd or Limbaugh'd or Foxed or CNN'd or MSNBC'd, because there's other stuff going on. But they're not going to be able to report on that because it's happening behind the scenes. There's a lot of different cooks in a lot of different kitchens right now, but the main ingredient in the incredible meal they're cooking up is love. And that's why I'm thrilled to present this conversation to you with Sharon Salzberg, who is an amazing teacher and who just happens to have written an amazing book called Real Love, which is a pragmatic investigation of a very confusing word. So we're going to jump right into that, friends. But first, some quick business. Friends, we're entering into the age of Aquarius, and you don't have a website. This, a reading from Nostradamus's fourth cantos, sixth verse in the Emerald Book of Poems. And there shall come a time when some of them will not have websites, and those that do not have websites will be set upon by wild dogs, their entrails ripped from their stomachs, their eyeballs clawed from their heads by zombies, their hair set ablaze, and their bodies pushed off of waterfalls into alligator pits. That's pretty eerie, considering Nostradamus had no idea that there would be an internet. But do you really want to risk that happening to you? Do you really want to risk being shoved off a waterfall into a pit of alligators just because you didn't create a beautiful website using squarespace.com? You can start your free trial today by going to squarespace.com and using offer code Duncan to get 10% off of a beautiful website. If you've been putting it off, if you're afraid of the complexity of creating a website, if you maybe feel like you don't have the cash to pay for a web designer, you have nothing to worry about. All you got to do is go to Squarespace, and you can use their intuitive, simple process and their beautiful, award-winning templates with customizable settings to put together a really beautiful looking website. Don't believe me? I use Squarespace. Go to DuncanTrussell.com. That is a website created using Squarespace. Also, they have seamless commerce tools. I've been using them for my shop and they're fantastic. Squarespace.com. Set your website apart. Go to Squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off a beautiful website. Sign up for a year and you will get a free domain name. I've got a live DTFH coming up on May 16th at the Bell House in Brooklyn with two of my favorite human beings on planet Earth, visionary artists Alex Gray and Allison Gray. Also, Emil Amos from the Holy Sons will be playing music up front. It's going to be a wonderful show. The ticket link is located at DuncanTrussell.com. Much thanks to those of you who continue to support the podcast by going through our Amazon link, which is located at DuncanTrussell.com. It's in the comments section of any of these episodes, and it's also on the very front page. Whenever you click through that link and buy some amazing thing on Amazon, we get a very small percentage of that, and it costs you nothing. We also have a shop located at DuncanTrussell.com with lots of posters, t-shirts, and stickers, and my eternal gratitude to those of you who have been donating to the podcast. Certainly not necessary, but much appreciated. Friends, we have a glorious podcast for you today. Today's guest is a world-renowned Buddhist teacher. I've been lucky enough to listen to some of her teachings here at the Spring Retreat. She is a mind blower. You can actually hear my mind get blown in this conversation. It's the first time I've ever had to actually pause an interview to think about the things that the guest has been telling me. She's incredible. She has written 10 books, her most recent being the book Real Love. You can actually order that book by going to her website, SharonSalzberg.com. All the links are going to be in the comments section of this episode. So now, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Sharon Salzberg. Sharon, thank you so much for being on my podcast. It is such an honor to sit down and chat with you.
Well, thank you. I'm so delighted you took this time.
All right, please.
Here we are.
You know, I kind of marvel at your mastery of being a teacher. And one of the signs of a master, and forgive me for immediately calling you a master, but one of the signs is they make something that is incredibly difficult seem like the most simple thing on earth. And when you get on in front of the retreat, and when I've seen you speak, you make it seem so easy. And I guess the first question I have for you is there some preparation that you do or some process that you go through prior to a speaking engagement to get you in the right mindset to be in such what appears to be a pretty profound flow state?
Thank you. I basically practice. You know, I try to obviously not be distracted by the news of the day or whatever may be, you know, causing me some angst or distraction, and really be present. I used to be terrified of public speaking, actually.
Wild.
And I was incapable of it. When I first began teaching, I began teaching because this teacher, this woman named Dupama, told me to teach. So I did it really the old-fashioned way. You know, I didn't go to a training program or learn how to. She told me to teach. She gave me her blessing.
Can you give me the context of that moment?
Sure. It was very interesting. I had been in India for a while. I had met her. She was an extraordinary woman who, like many women of her time, she'd been put into an arranged marriage when she was 12 years old. But she and her husband actually fell really deeply in love, which didn't always happen. And they didn't have any children for about 18 years, which was considered disgraceful and her problem. And then they had three children and two of them died. Mm. And then they were living in Burma at the time, and her husband was in the civil service there, even though they were Bengali. They were living in Burma, and he wasn't feeling well one day, so he came home from work a little early, and he had died by that night. So she was completely grief-stricken. She still had a daughter, Deepa. So her nickname is Deepa's mother, Deepa Ma.
Okay, I see.
She still had deep in her rays, but she was completely grief-stricken. She developed a heart condition. She couldn't get out of bed. And the doctor came and said to her, you're actually going to die of a broken heart unless you learn to do something about your mind. You should learn how to meditate. So she got up. She got out of bed. She went to the meditation center, and they said the temple room, the meditation room, was like up on the, we would call it the second floor. And she was too weak to walk up the stairs, so she crawled up the stairs to get into the meditation room.
Wow.
And she learned how to meditate. And when she came out, she had somehow metabolized all of that pain into the most amazing, beautiful compassion. So she was the most loving, compassionate person in a very simple way, you know, not right. like, wasn't very grandiose or showy. She was just so there. So I had met her. She was one of my teachers, and I was getting ready.
How do you meet somebody like that?
I met her because I was practicing with someone who had been her teacher when she was in Burma, and he was now living in Bodh Gaya in India, and he was one of my teachers. So he said, oh, I have a student. You must meet her. Like that. That's how it happens.
I'm doing this interview in the wrong direction. How do you end up in that situation?
I had gone to India. I was 18. I was a junior in college. I am a product of the New York City public school system, where they used to like to skip a lot of grades for people.
Right.
So I skipped two grades. I went to college when I was 16.
Wow.
And the university had an independent study program, and if you created a project that they liked, you could go anywhere in the world theoretically for a year and then come back. So I had taken an Asian philosophy course. I heard there was this thing called meditation.
Got it.
If you practiced it, you could get to be a whole lot happier. You wouldn't be, you know.
Were you not happy?
I wasn't happy. I mean, I'd had a very, like many people, a very traumatic, difficult childhood. And like for many people, mine was a family system where this was never, ever spoken about. And so I didn't know what to do with all of those feelings inside of me.
Abuse there?
It wasn't so much abuse, but it was tumultuous loss. Like, my parents split up when I was 4. My father disappeared. I lived with my mother and her 2 siblings. She died when I was 9. And then I went to live with my father's parents, whom I hardly knew. There had been no word from him since I'd been 4.
How old were you when you...
When my mother died? I was 9.
9.
So that was 5 years later. And then I lived with my grandparents. And then when I was 11, my grandfather died, his father. So my father came back. This is the first time I'd seen him since I was 4. And, maybe 6 weeks later, he took an overdose of sleeping pills. And he didn't die, but he spent the rest of his life in some mental health facility or another, some kind, or, you know, nursing home or psych hospital or VA hospital or something, and or on the streets. And, you know, so it was this huge sort of dislocation and feeling of not belonging. And
there's just no rest there.
Yeah,
there was no rest.
That's absolutely right. There was no rest. And I was like very, very fragmented. And I knew it. I mean, I didn't know exactly what was happening. I wasn't sophisticated in that way. But somehow, and this is like the magic of it all, I heard there was a thing called meditation, that if you practiced it, you could be happier. And I just knew I had to learn how to do it. I couldn't study it. I couldn't reflect about it. I couldn't write papers about it. I had to learn how to do it.
When was the first time you tried it?
Well, I went to India.
So you didn't try it before you went to
India? No, no, no. I didn't know how to do it. I mean, really? So this is a long time ago. I'm really kind of old now. You know, this is 1970 we're talking about.
As I was reading your book, I just kept thinking, I wonder when the first time, like, you know, clearly you've had these incredible teachers, but you didn't you felt something when you read about it, but you weren't like, oh, I'm going to go back to my, were you in a dorm room? You were living in
I was in a dorm room.
You weren't like, you didn't try, like, I'm just going to go to the dorm room, I'm going to sit down.
Sit and say om or something like that.
you didn't try anything like that.
I remember, 1968, 1969, something like that, hearing for the first time the music from Hair, the musical.
Yes.
And I didn't even remember that Om Mani Padme Hum was in it until I saw it a few years ago. But I remembered Hare Krishna.
Okay.
And I remember just being filled with bliss listening to Hare Krishna. Wow. I go, what is this feeling? But, you know, and but I didn't really know how to do it. And this was, you know, I left for India in 1970. I was going to school in Buffalo, New York. I mean, maybe it existed somewhere, but
right.
I didn't know where. I didn't, you know, I knew about TM, but I didn't do it, you know, so.
Because, yeah, you were surrounded by people who were talking about meditating and stuff, but you wanted to go to the place that all of this data was coming from at the time and still is. So did you fly to India or you?
I went with a couple of friends. We went the kind of standard way people went then, flew to Europe, took the Orient Express across to Istanbul, then took buses and trains across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Were there people you had to leave? Were you seeing anyone? Did you have any significant relationships? Did you have to leave anyone behind?
No. I went with my boyfriend and a couple of friends. And
okay. So this is an adventure with your...
Yeah.
Is that your first boyfriend?
Not exactly.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So you went with your boyfriend to India on this amazing...
Yeah.
The ultimate thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to India... to learn to meditate.
Yeah.
With my boyfriend. And what happened?
We started out in Dharamsala. I was very interested in Buddhism. And again, I don't know why. You know, it was just a kind of magical thing. And I didn't even realize India had not been a Buddhist country for a few thousand years, you know.
Yeah.
I just, like, I had to go. So I knew the Dalai Lama was a Buddhist. I knew he lived in Dharamsala. So we started out in Dharamsala. And
was he there?
Yeah, he was there. He was very accessible. You know, he was very young. And
more accessible than now?
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, now it's like, you know, layers and layers of security. And you
so
know.
Then you could just walk down the street, and he'd be
walking, you know, or whatever. I mean, he had some security, but not like now. And
wow.
I had this, like, it's such an interesting reflection. Like, what was going on in me? Like, this passion. Like, I had to learn how to do it. And that particular school, it tends to be very scholarly. You really study a lot before you get down to the how-to. And it was just one of those things, you know, those circumstances.
I'm sorry, that school, by that school?
The Dalai Lama School of Tibetan Buddhism is a particularly scholarly approach.
Okay, so even before they teach you, sit down, follow your breath.
That's
You have to start learning about the, the history of Buddhism?
You have to start learning about the mind, about levels of consciousness, why you would want to meditate, and what meditation would do. And
okay, why you would want to. That's hilarious. And you had a translator?
Yeah, I was always a translator.
And did you guys have to pay someone to do this? Like, how do you make an arrangement with the...
No, I mean, the teachers were beautiful, and they wanted to teach, and so they had translators that they had confidence in.
But I mean, to enroll in this kind of academy, what is the arrangement you have to make to begin to even take those lessons?
Well, there were classes, and they were very freely offered. The problem was that it was one of those circumstances, which, you know, is not only in India, but India is kind of famous for it, where it just didn't work. You know, like, I'd go to the class to learn how to meditate finally, and they'd say, "Oh, the translator went away for 2 weeks. Come back in two weeks.
Right,
Come back in 2 weeks." And I said, the teacher had to go to the dentist, who's at the other end of India. Who knows when he's coming back?
Were you renting a house there?
It was a house. It's too elegant a word. It's kind of like a cow shed. Yeah,
like a cow shed.
Yeah.
And you were living there with your boyfriend.
Yeah.
And were you guys in love?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah,
it's so romantic. It was like... to go with your boyfriend to Dharamsala to study meditation. It's just
You're so wonderful.
It's so romantic.
And you are wonderful.
Oh, thanks. So I'm just trying to picture it just because it's such a beautiful. Well, okay. From where I'm sitting, having like, been something of your student. I've sat and listened to you, and my life has changed because of your teachings. So it really is interesting to think about you before you realized, I am going to, certainly if somebody came up to you and said, well, just so you know, you're going to be one of the great teachers of Buddhism in the West.
Yeah.
Would you have bought into that at all?
Never. Even when I, you know, 4 years later now, when I went to see Deepama in Calcutta, I went, I mean, I stayed longer than my allotted year in India. I went back to Buffalo, finished school, went back to India. So that brings us to 1974. And I was leaving India for what I was positive was a very short trip back to the States before I went back to India to live the entire rest of my life there. And I went to see her to get her blessing for my very short journey back. And that's when she said, when you go back, you'll be teaching.
Oh, my.
And I said, no, I won't. God. And she said, yes, you will. And I said, no, I won't. She said, yes, you will. I said, no, I won't. And then she said these two things that were really amazing. She said, I remember her story, right? Her life story being what it is. She said, you really understand suffering. That's why you should teach.
Oh.
And it wasn't like you have peerless understanding of life, you know, of the texts, or, you know, you really understand suffering. That's why you should teach. And it was, I'm sure, the first time in my life I thought about those experiences as having given me something, you know.
Can we, I just,
yeah,
I want to picture this moment. As
yeah.
In like, were you, what room were you sitting in? Where, what were your surroundings? Were mm-hmm. there other people in the room with you when this happened?
Well, it must have been her daughter to translate. She lived in what we would consider like a tenement. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't the worst of Calcutta by any means, but you had to walk up these really dark, rank, rat-infested stairs, mm-hmm. you know. And she had a room. She and her daughter lived in a room, and the bath. You know, every household had their own room around an open area, and like the staircase kind of area, and there was one bathroom they all shared. There was one kitchen they all shared. Huh. And it was a very small room, but that was their life, you know. Like,
what pictures are on the wall?
Like a Buddha, you know,
okay.
And very simple, you know, but filled with light. That's what was always so interesting. It was like so dreadful as a physical, you know, experience. And you'd finally get up those stairs. And, like,
yeah.
You'd sit in her room and it was like filled with light.
Incense burning?
No, not so much. But
light from the window or
no,
light
from
her?
Light from her.
Wow. So you're sitting in the presence of this,
yeah.
One of them.
Yeah.
And one of them is saying to you, you're going to teach.
That's right.
How did you, what was the feeling?
I can't do that. That's impossible. That means I have to not be you, but I have to be closer to you than I am right now. You
right.
know, like. Than to who I feel myself to be. I have to, like, really, you know, get going here, you know.
Right.
That's not possible. I can't possibly, you know, be of that caliber. And which is the second thing she said to me. You know, she kept saying, you're going to do it. And I kept saying, no, I'm not. And then she said, you can do anything you want to do, but you're thinking you can't do it that's going to stop you.
Ah, okay.
And I left her light-filled presence and walked down those horrible stairs, and I kept thinking, I'm not going to teach. You know, that's not going to happen.
Really?
Yeah.
So you have essentially an enlightened being
yeah.
telling you,
yeah.
and yet still skeptical.
Yeah.
Wow.
What to say?
No ego inflation? No, because I to have a being
more,
like
probably
that.
More terror than anything.
Wow.
You know, I was like, I can't do that. That's insane, you know? Like,
man, that is really, really fascinating to me. I just feel like if someone said that to me, I don't know. I'd feel like I was in a dream, or I'd feel like I was going crazy, or I'd feel, wow. Were you still in this relationship at the time?
Yes.
Where was he?
Where was he?
The relationship.
The boyfriend?
Yeah, your boyfriend.
Yeah, it's hard to remember. This is a long time ago. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't, it was close to over. But
close to over.
Yeah, it was close to over.
If it's not too personal,
no,
may I
okay.
ask why?
Life was just moving on in you know, different directions. I mean, we were very young, of course.
Sure.
And while really both, I think, moved by the practice and There was always this kind of tension, you know, of like diving deep and living the yogi life, or you know, being a householder, going back to grad school or something, you know,
right?
Getting that accomplishment, and we just took these different directions,
different paths.
Yeah,
was it heartbreaking?
Yeah, I mean, in a certain way. I mean, I never would have wanted it to be other than it was. It wasn't that kind of heartbreaking where you think, this is just wrong. This shouldn't be this way.
Right.
No, it was right. But, you know, it was very sad. I mean, just given my, you know, life history of abandonment and devastation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you by then you were being pulled into something much bigger than something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe he was too. Who knows?
Yeah.
So, when you came back to the United States, I've heard when they talk about the Buddha's enlightenment, they talk about these temptations. Mm-hmm. And the second temptation, the daughters of Mara appear, and they tempt the Buddha. And I've heard someone say that, well, the daughters of Mara, it's not what most people think it means. It doesn't mean like some kind of ability to marry someone. But it's the part of your mind that says to you, you're getting, you know, you're awakening. You're beginning to get enlightened. As you come back to the United States and you begin, you're doing this practice. I read in your book, as you're talking about doing this loving kindness meditation and the first beginning flickerings of actually loving yourself happening. Do you struggle at all with a feeling that you are an enlightened being or on the precipice, so close to actually like waking up?
No.
Not at all.
No, I mean, it's different. You know, like I have been practicing, this has been my world for, you know, more than 45 years. I mean, I met people like Krishnadas and Ramdas at my first meditation retreat, January of 1971.
Okay.
That's where we first met. So Krishnadas and I were sitting, somewhere having lunch and in this room with a lot, it was at a retreat, you know, and he was visiting. And so all these other people were there and somebody said, how long have you two known each other? And we said like 45 years. And they thought we said 4 years. And they were like, wow, that's a long time. And like, we said, no, I had a few decades to that.
Yeah. But Sharon, this is such a unique incarnation. Not all all incarnations are unique. I'm not trying to produce some kind of spiritual hierarchy or anything, but when you look at the life experience of most people, it does not involve becoming a Buddhist teacher. It does not involve writing lots of books that are healing people's lives. It doesn't. So it's safe to say you are in this very unique incarnation. You are a kind of, I don't mean to lower what it is, but in a strange way, you're a celebrity.
I am. I know that.
And so, if I were in your shoes, there would just be these moments of clarity of thinking, what am I, what is this that I've gotten myself into here? What am I doing? What am I becoming? Where did I come from?
Yeah.
Are there past lives here that brought me to this point?
Oh, I'm sure there were. You know, I guess my mind doesn't go there. I agree in some weird way. I'm like a celebrity. The last two times I was at an airport, somebody's come up to me and said, are you Sharon Salzberg?
Yeah.
The second time in terms of, you know, the first time it happened recently, my flight out of San Francisco was 6.5 hours late, and this was like 5.5 hours into that, and I was fine for the first 5.5 hours, and then I was just going down, and somebody came up to me and said, are you Sharon Salzberg? And I thought, 2 more minutes, I would have been having a temper tantrum, look at that. And then coming here, somebody came up to me in the airport and said, are you Sharon Salzberg? And I said, yeah. And then I thought, of course, they were coming to this course on Maui, and then I said, oh, you go to Maui? And she said, no, I'm going to like Rochester or someplace, you know, like.
Wild. And they don't just say you're Sharon Salisbury. They just say you changed my life.
That's right. That's what they say.
You healed
That's
me.
True. That's true.
I was screwed, man. I was screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, me. And then I have one of something that I refer to that you taught me in a very graceful way. Your teaching style is very graceful, but it is the healing is in the return.
Yeah, that's right.
And, oh, I love that. And that gives me so much permission to mess up and so much permission to come back. Because it's like we mess up. I mess up enough. And then I think, you know what? I'm just not going to try it again. Because what's the point? Mm-hmm. It never works out. And then to have that ability to, oh, no.
Yeah.
When you sit down and just try it one more time.
Yeah.
That's where it's at.
Yeah, that's totally where it's at. It's absolutely true. I mean, I don't say that because I think it's consolation, you know, or I think it's true.
When
I know it's
true. When did that come to you? When did that thought come to you?
It's part of the way I put together my own understanding. Of course, it's classical, but it's my own understanding of how things really work, you know, because we think if we try really, really, really hard and kind of grit our teeth and try to tough it out, we'll do better, and we don't do better. And we think if we judge ourselves harshly enough, we'll do better, and we don't.
Right. And this brings me to a question I had from your book. You talk about self-love. We have to love ourselves. And intellectually, yes, God, that sounds great. It sounds so good. But I'm really curious about when is it self-love and when is it denial? When is it that I am, okay, yes, I look at myself in the mirror, I got it. You know that this doesn't happen to you. That the horrible thing happens where a mirror ends up behind you in the right angle so you can really see your bald spot. It's the worst.
I've never thought of that.
Oh, it's the worst because, like, it's so easy to forget about your bald spot because you don't ever look at it. Everyone else has to see it. You're like, I don't remember that thing. I forgot it was riding on my head at all times. And then, oh, you look and you're there it is. And then you're like, oh, I can't. I don't feel love for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel love for that. And there's other things, too. You know, like procrastination. You know, certain things, certain habits of a life. Where when I look at that, I think I don't. Not only do I not love that, but I'm afraid that if I did love my procrastination, if I did love my tendencies to get addicted to things, if I did love my anger, I would be doomed.
Yeah,
I would spiral into some kind of monstrous version of myself. So, can you please explain to me how we can differentiate loving oneself from being in denial about work that must be done?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think that some of it is really how we use the word love and what it means to us. And I had this funny experience the other day looking back over the books that I've written, because this next one is going to be my 10th book.
Wow.
And I just realized that it seems to be that one of my passions is kind of reclaiming words. You know, it's like, because I think when we lose the power of a certain word, we lose the possibility it can give us. So, like, I wrote, for example, this book on faith. It's called Faith. And even my friends gave me a hard time about that. You know, like, right. Why in the world are you writing on faith? Because for many people, faith has come to mean being silenced and not being able to ask questions and losing self-respect and just giving yourself over to someone else's vision of what's true, you know. And I wanted to help reclaim the word because it doesn't mean that to me. And love is another one of those words, you know, that clearly has come for many people to mean kind of acquiescence, or to say you love your procrastination or love your anger. Yeah. Doesn't mean you're giving into it, and it doesn't mean that you're applauding it and saying, good, go for it, you know, get right. Stronger. But this sort of almost viciousness, the unjustness with which we treat ourselves, you know, shouldn't be thinking that. Well, how do you not think a certain thought? That's impossible.
Right.
You know.
Before that question I just asked, I had one before that's okay, very sure, important sure. for that yeah, question yeah. to work. What is love?
Oh, there you go. I don't know that I know.
You just wrote a book. I know. Do you have some pragmatic
yeah.
definition?
Yeah. I mean, I think it, I don't know how pragmatic it is, but it is my working definition. I think of it as a certain way of connecting that's very full on, very open, and authentic. You know, it's not like a pretense of like, I like you when I really don't, or I approve of you when I really don't. And I see love as that moment of connection, but not necessarily equating it with a certain form. You know, that's what people confuse. The commitment is the commitment. It's not the love. Or the pattern of the relationship is the pattern of the relationship. That's not the love.
Okay. Okay, so this is a mode of connectivity.
Yeah, it's a mode of connectivity, exactly. Almost the whole book came out of this line, actually, from a movie called Dan in Real Life, which is, I don't know, maybe like 12 years old now, something like that. And one of the characters in the movie says, love is not a feeling, it's an ability. Hmm. And I was really struck with that when I first heard it all those years ago. And love is not a feeling, it's an ability. Because we do think of it as a feeling. We think of it as a commodity. And for me, it was always in someone else's hands. You know, to give to me, in which case there would be love in my life, or to take away from me. Right. In which case, I'd have no love in my life.
Like they're love dealers. They're like dealing.
Exactly.
Love.
I thought of it actually as the UPS delivery person who was like had the package in their hand, standing on my doorstep, and changed their mind.
This is, I mean, what in your book, there is this, as many mystics do, you're pointing in the direction of this possibility.
Yeah.
You don't need a person, situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To be in love.
Mm-hmm.
But can we talk about back in India, the relationship for you ends. This is a big, I don't know what exactly it was, but this is a big deal, man. You went to India. You grew with this person. Mm-hmm. You were studying with the Dalai Lama with this person. And at some point, you're walking down the street and that's gone. And all the theories and all the teachings. You know what I'm talking
sure.
about?
Yeah,
that
totally.
Everything now is just dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Though it is worse. It's just like you're just surrounded by dead matter and it's pointless. And like you see a thing that reminds you of the when you were with the person and when that thing was beautiful mm-hmm. when you were the. But that thing now is just like a tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
So you're walking through a graveyard. Heartbreak. So how does a person listening to this now who lost love,
mm-hmm.
this mode of connectivity, it's like, no. Well, I slept with this person. We made love. I know what she smells like. I know her essence. It defined everything for me. Gone.
Mm-hmm.
Mode of connectivity. No, I want that back.
Yeah.
Is it possible at that level minus the person?
Oh, totally.
At that level, at the level of listening to music when you're driving and crying because you're thinking of them, the level of like, oh, I'm going to write them a... I'm going to learn calligraphy.
All right.
At that level, it's possible.
Well, I don't know if I know exactly what you mean by
you
that.
You mean
level.
I'm going to learn
that level of intensity yes. and aliveness. And
yes.
Yes, it's possible. I really believe it's possible. Because I think, first of all, that's the reality of our experience. I think that
wow.
the, I mean, you're painting a picture of desolation, which is very real to me because look at my earlier life,
yes.
you know, so the loss of a relationship has been, you know, incredibly triggering, of course, you know, of some very early traumas.
Yes.
But interestingly enough, that is not true for everybody.
Wow.
And I've always, you know, it's a little like anthropology, you know, you listen to these people and there's like, I'm going on.
Right.
You know, thanks for the gifts. And you think, really? You're going on? You're not like crying? You know?
Right,
like,
right.
You know,
I see what you're saying.
I wouldn't say that's absolutely true for everybody.
Okay,
you know,
so like, some of us are like reliving the loss of our parents.
That's right.
And childhood, the divorce.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you're your lover leaves you and you're not really missing them. You're like going back to when you were a child
in
the Garden of Eden that had a meteor smash into it.
Yeah.
Oh,
and so it's a question of survival, right, when you're a child.
Wow.
And so this is not a small measure of loss. You know, this is life and death is what it feels like.
Yes.
And so it feels like that at 35, too. And
yes.
You know, if that's your background and if you haven't quite worked through a lot of that,
right.
You know, residue. So.
Whoa, that's heavy. Okay, so, that's cool. Okay. Well, do you – so you've – I'm just very interested in this – mode of connectivity and this idea that I can wake up in the morning with or without someone.
Mm-hmm.
I can turn on the news. The Republicans are like the Republicans are just like everything's a pre-existing condition. No one's getting health care anymore or whatever the thing is.
Everything is a pre-existing condition. You see that list?
And I can look at all of that and still be in love.
Yeah.
I want, Sharon, I do believe you.
Yeah.
And I felt it a little bit from time to time. But my love is dependent. I do not feel a perpetual mode of connectivity. There are huge gaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would hesitate to say I feel a perpetual mode of, because remember, the healing is in the return.
Right.
It's like we blow it, we lose it, we get disconnected, and then we can remember, oh, right, that isn't the path I want to keep following. You know, I've been there. I know where that leads to. That really hurts. Let me come back to this moment. And you may come back briefly, but you're back.
Right.
And that is a very significant kind of healing moment.
Do you think that your definition of love is dependent on life? To exist? Does it precede planet Earth? Was there love before there was a planet Earth?
I have never thought of that before. Wow. I'm too Buddhist, I guess. You know, like, time is beginningless. The universe is beginningless.
Okay.
I've never thought of that before.
The Earth is not beginningless. The Earth had a beginning. And there was this, where we're – what we're on right now used to just be dust that coalesced into a – so –
Yeah, I'm going to be bold and say yes. I do believe that because, you know, just feeling like the life force. But again, it depends on what you mean by love. It doesn't mean being pleased or the reason I tried to make that differentiation early on was because between the connectivity and the form is because loving someone doesn't mean, I don't believe it means you like them or you want to spend time with them. You know, or you want to go to dinner, or you want to have them over for Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's
beautiful. You know, and because we feel that it does mean that, and we fear it means that.
Yes.
Then we think, I can't possibly open to that person because then I am stuck, you know, having to give them money or whatever it is.
Absolutely. Someone just asked me this question on Twitter, which I didn't answer. Because I have no idea the answer, but you just answered. The question is, how do I love a person who is definitely going to hurt me?
Mm-hmm.
No question about it. Not like, oh, maybe a monster, an abuser, whoever it may be. How do I love that person? What does that look like in the real world? If there's a person in your life that you do love, for better, for worse, but you know they hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
How do you? What is the expression of love in that situation?
I think it's a kind of compassion. You know, like some people hurt others almost willfully. You know, because they think that's how they will be happy. Like vengefulness, putting other people down, puffing themselves up. Other people, or all of us at different times, hurt people because we're just lost. You know, like some stupid thought comes up in our minds, and before we know it, we've acted on it, and then we think. I mean, I talked to a guy in death row once in Georgia. It was just like that. I'm gonna rob this guy and pay all day. Who's it gonna hurt? But the guy he was with had a gun, and then the guy pulled the gun, and just like, you know, like one thought,
right?
You know, and so I do think we can have a kind of compassion for somebody, but that doesn't mean you want to spend any time with them. You know, or you're not going to become a victim.
But they need your time. What if they need your time? What if they're asking for your time. They want your presence in their life. But when you put your presence in their life, they inevitably hurt you.
I think there's a balance, you know, like, you know, balance is a hard word because, first of all, it sounds really boring, but I don't think it's really boring.
Yeah.
But it's also not static, you know, like if you're taking care of yourself and having compassion for yourself and also having compassion for someone else, there's not one way that's going to look. But absolutely, I've known many, many cases where somebody has made the decision, no, I can't go visit that person. It wouldn't physically be safe. I right. can't go visit them. You know, they abused me when I was a year and a half old. They're still in jail. You know, people ask that kind of question all the time. Does having compassion for that person mean I have to go see them? I really don't believe it does, you know, because there's elements of discernment and context and seeing where you're at and, you know, what happened the last 15 times you went to see them.
Right.
You know, and how much energy do you feel? How much, you know, how tired are you? And all kinds of stuff plays into that decision. But in your heart, you don't have to be full of hatred. And you don't want to be full of hatred either.
No. No. It's just these teachings are the kinds of things that you read about, and it gets really confusing because you get into the real world, and it's, you know, one thing that just happened is the suddenly we have this, it's not a new thing, but they're getting a lot of in the spotlight right now, the Antifa. Right. So the Antifa are the people who wear the.
Oh, yeah.
And they punch people. They pepper spray people. They're violent. And they're violent because they believe that what's happening is like fascism is rearing its head in the West right now. And that, and, you know, it's one. You know, I go to these retreats so much. And in the retreats, these love. We must love, compassion, forgiveness. And I love it. But. And I've interacted with some of these people on Twitter, and they say, oh, are you going to open your heart to listen to what Benito Mussolini has to say? You're going to sit down and have a nice, open-hearted chat with Adolf Hitler? Or are you going to put a bullet in his head the moment that you see him? Because what it turns into is so much worse.
Mm-hmm.
So... when the rubber hit, where does the rubber hit the road?
Mm-hmm.
When theoretically, and we know historically, things can get bad. And I'm not just saying, oh, you know, the right wing suddenly takes over and America turns into some kind of fascist police state. It could happen for, it could swing to the left just as easily, where people on the left get so freaked out that they start really fighting back. And now we have a civil war. Who knows? But so where does this kind of teaching play into self-defense, rebellion, revolution, and all the things that are necessary to survive in a tumultuous world, which politically changes radically, very quickly throughout history?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a very tumultuous world. And I don't know if you remember this morning when I was doing questions and answers, and I had said in my talk, something about how meditation is a resilience training. And what someone heard was meditation is a resistance training.
Yes.
And that's what she asked me about. And I said, did I say that? And, you know, all these people said, no, you didn't say that. But that's what was on her mind, you know. So, and I think it can be a kind of resistance training. I mean, none of this is easy. But I don't believe in moral relativism. Oh. I don't believe all views are equal.
Okay.
And, you know, all of this, like, we have to sit down together and we have to hear one another out. I think we do because we have to learn to recognize ourselves and one another. But I don't believe all views are equal and that every view is valid. I think some views, including some of my own views, no doubt, are just imbued with incredible ignorance. And
is that a personal appraisal or does that have its roots in Buddhism?
Personally, I believe it has its roots in Buddhism because there is an ethical code, you know, and it's not meant to be imprisoning, but I think killing girl babies is wrong, for example, no matter, even if it's been part of your culture forever, even if
Killing what?
Girl babies, you know.
Oh, I thought you said gorilla babies.
No. Well, that would be kind of bad too, you know.
I agree. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know,
right.
So I don't think sitting any number of chats, you know, with somebody
right.
who thinks that's the right way to go is going to produce this kumbaya moment. I don't think so, and it shouldn't.
Well, this point of view that you have, I share this point of view. And it's not really a very popular point of view.
I know.
Because it's a point of view that demands action.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you decide, yeah, there's really no cultural relativism, it's you're talking about genital mutilation in some cases, mm-hmm. or you're mm-hmm. talking mm-hmm. about, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to sit down with someone from ISIS to debate whether it makes sense to throw gay people off the top of a mm-hmm. building somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to mm-hmm. sit down with a lunatic and hope that, like, maybe, well, you know what, maybe I'll be swayed. Maybe at the end of the conversation, I'll be like, you know, you got a point. But no, there's a comedian, Mark Maron, who has a fantastic joke about how he's afraid to read Dianetics because he thinks that, like, somewhere in there, he'll be like, you know what, this kind of makes sense. Where does a religion or a philosophy of compassion and love and forgiveness and self-love, where does it work in a world where apparently sometimes people have to be stopped?
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you compassionately address the rise of fringe ideologies in a world where people are getting increasing access to destructive technologies?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it depends on what you mean by love and what you mean by compassion. Because, I mean, they say the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation as the antidote to fear. He didn't teach it to be more pleasant in the world, you know, or have better dinner parties or, you know, sit down with disreputable people and sort of have a nice evening. He taught it as the end of fear, the antidote to fear.
So. Never heard that. That is a mind blower.
Yeah. So if you think of it that way, the fear doesn't add clarity to the situation.
Wow.
You know, a sense of options about how to act. And the hatred doesn't either, you know, because you can, I think, take an incredibly strong stand against someone's actions and fight, you know, really fight. But at the same time, you can kind of see, well, yeah, you know, like if I'd grown up in that circumstance or if I had that kind of conditioning or
right.
if I had that belief system, like it makes weird sense, you know, that but I'm going to work anyway to try to stop it, you know, with everything in me. But
so you don't think Buddhism and passivism are synonymous?
I think that nonviolence is not pacifism, first of all, you know, in that sense of it's not being passive.
Okay.
Nonviolence can have very strong action, but
that's called ahimsa?
Yeah. Nonviolence, okay. Yeah. Non-harming. But, you know, there's a story I tell in my book in the third section, which I'll get to, about this time I had the chance to – I spent the day with this guy named Miles Horton who had founded this school in Tennessee. It used to be called the Highlander Folk School. It's still there. I don't know what it's called now. But it's kind of like a training ground for civil rights workers. That's where Rosa Parks went there and all these people went there. And It got into big trouble because there it was in the South and it was an integrated facility and, you know, there was a lot of pressure. And so Miles Horton had been the founder and we ended up together. He was visiting a friend of mine who had to go to work. So I spent the day with him in Northampton. And at one point we started talking about loving kindness meditation because that's so much my thing. And
yes.
And he said, oh, Marty, Martin Luther King Jr., Marty used to say to me, you got to love everybody. And I used to say, no, I don't. I only have to love the people who deserve to be loved. And Marty would laugh and laugh, and he would say, nope, got to love everybody. And, you know, I haven't often told that story, but I see every time I do tell it, there's someone in the room who says, well, look what happened to him. He got assassinated, as though there were cause and effect there. as though if Martin Luther King Jr. had been hateful and bitter and vengeful, right, and he would have been safe.
Right.
That's where we think strength lies. And we think that that sense of loving everybody was his undoing, but not really. You know, it doesn't have to be seen as a weakness and a kind of degradation of our power. And I think it actually gives us a kind of power.
And that is, I mean, it's okay. Just please fix this for me, because it is like, mushy. I mean, God, I just, like, you know, love. I look at myself in the mirror, and that is not love. And I can fake it. I can be like, oh, aging body, you know. But and I'll try it. You know, straw hair, receding hairline. I look at myself in the mirror and I love you.
I don't do that either. You know, like, people think that loving kindness practice is like whatever that Saturday Night Live character that Al Franken played you know, you're wonderful. It's not like
it's
that.
It's not that.
It's not that.
So I don't have to do that.
You don't have to do that. I couldn't, I'm a New Yorker. I couldn't bear to do that. You know, like, No.
You're saying no mirror affirmations in Buddhism? No doing that?
Well, it's actually, it's interesting because loving kindness is not an affirmation practice. I've never done an affirmation practice, so I don't want to like put it down as though I knew, you know, anything about it, which I really don't. But it's not the same thing. It's a generosity practice. It's like you're giving yourself a break. You're giving yourself a gift of paying attention differently. You're giving others quality of attention we don't usually give to others. You know, it's like we're in a hurry.
Oh,
you're in my way.
Oh, I misunderstood this completely. When I hear you do these, oh, complete misapprehension. Because I, when I've heard you, oh wow, man, I'm sorry.
That's right.
Like, I have to pause and like assimilate the data. Like, in an interview like this, you have to like, you're not supposed to like stammer and like have the gears in your brain start breaking. Okay, because I just, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Okay, well, I've been doing it all wrong. I
well, I can help you.
walk me through the loving kindness meditation so we can talk about it, so that I can hear this no longer as a ridiculous, shallow, pointless affirmation.
Okay,
and not that that's what I've heard from you, but rather I think that's what I've been doing to some degree. Mm-hmm. So can we just go through it for a second?
I really think that loving kindness or compassion meditation, they're very similar, are about paying attention differently. So instead of, for example, being so distracted or fragmented, we're really, really present. So we gather all that kind of stray energy, the distractedness, and we kind of arrive more fully. So that's how we connect, right? Because we're actually there. And then the question comes up very strongly of what do we pay attention to? It's like if you think of yourself and you only think of those flaws.
Yes.
And you only think about aging.
Yes.
Then that's a pretty partial picture. You know, it's not to say that.
Right.
Everything's perfect, but it's not only, you know, that. And so let's fill in the picture a little bit. Let's look for the good.
Right.
As nauseating as that might seem.
Right.
You know, or look at the potential we have to change, or look at how we can begin again, or let's look at a bigger picture so that we're not only looking at our own flaws or someone else's flaws.
It feels like there's like a spectrum of self.
Yeah.
And that you're getting distracted by these little flecks on the spectrum of self, and that you're talking about widening that out to some kind of totality.
That's
of
right.
Being.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And then what I find a really, really crucial question in society is, who do we pay attention to? Who have we dehumanized? Or it could be doggy to begin with. Who have we depersonalized?
Right.
So that they're an object. They're not a feeling being for us. You know, who do we objectify? Who doesn't count? Who doesn't matter? And we continually expand. So it's like a stretching practice, you know, like we realize, okay, I've got this narrow spectrum of beings I actually pay attention to. I'm going to broaden. I'm going to stretch. I'm going to include walking into that grocery store and looking at the person who's working behind the counter, not through them.
Right.
I'm going to look at the homeless person asking me for money, not through them. You know, we're just continually stretching in that way. And it's a, also, it's a much more inclusive and much truer picture of life. So even though it's not always pleasant and it can be quite, quite painful, it's real. You know, that's what our life is. It's not just this narrow little band of beings that we acknowledge as having feelings, you know, and living in this sort of mechanistic world apart from that.
Right. Where are you on this spec? Like, where, what are you? What are you, Sharon?
Well, the Buddha, which I am not. When he, you know, he was asked after his enlightenment, like, who are you? And he said, I'm awake. So I'm not awake, but I'm on the path. Like,
when you're going to bed at night.
Yeah.
And what? And you're laying there. What? Where? It's a terrible question. Whoever asked the Buddha that question was a real dumb. Was probably doing a
is
a
the first
podcast.
Person is the first person. No, it's actually an interesting story. I believe it's a the Buddha got enlightened sitting under a tree, as you know.
Yes.
After facing all those armies of Mara, and he spent 49 days in the immediate vicinity of the tree, 7 activities of 7 days each. He did walking meditation for 7 days. He looked at the tree in gratitude for 7 days for having sheltered him.
Wow.
He did all these things for 7 days each, and then at the end of 49 days, he got up to go walk to a nearby town and meet up with his old friends, and he came upon a person who was like struck by his radiance because it's only like 49 days after the big enlightenment.
Yeah.
And the man said, who are you? Like, what are you? Are you some kind of supernatural being? Are you a heavenly creature? Who are you? And the Buddha said, I am awake. And the guy basically said, yeah, maybe. And he walked away. So I use that as an example of the, it's like cynicism, you know, like, it's okay to not believe. Like, why would you? That's an outrageous claim. You don't have to believe it. But what about sticking around, you know, and finding out more and asking more questions,
right,
and probing and, you know, can anybody be awake? Can I be awake? What would it mean? You know,
you don't think of yourself as awake.
I think of it as a gradation. You know, I'm certainly a lot more awake than I used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think that you... I'm sorry to ask kind of like tabloid questions, but
no, we're friends.
do you think that you could achieve realization in this life?
It's hard to say because, like, different schools, different frameworks, you know, talk about it in different ways. In a partial and growing sense, absolutely. I think we all can. You know, I think that the way I conceive of it is not like final, perfect, ultimate liberation, because that, I think, may take a few lifetimes, God knows. But I think all of us have experiences from which there is no turning back. We don't always live in harmony with what we've seen.
Yeah.
But if we were ever asked, we absolutely know that's what we've seen. That's what's true. You know, so I might forget... you know, hatred doesn't bring what I want. And I might get lost.
Yeah.
But if I actually looked or you asked me, I would absolutely know. No, that's not the way.
Right.
That's not the way. And okay. I think we all have those moments from which there's no turning back. And that's a kind of realization or liberation.
That's a huge liberation.
Yeah.
Do you think, right, living today, there are liberated beings on this planet?
I do.
What are they doing?
I think some of them are hanging out in caves, you know, and they're praying for the rest of us, the sorry lot that we are.
Why? It seems like there is a quality to, at some point, lots of these people, they do that. They go into some kind of cave, metaphorical cave. They don't, you know, why is it that these people who I intuitively believe exist, why is one of their qualities that of camouflaging themselves?
Oh, I don't know if it's camouflage so much as it's not boasting in some way. You know, it's like if you met my teacher Deepama, who she would never say she was fully realized, but she was well along the way. You know, I'm sure.
But she sent you,
yeah,
into the world.
She did,
and that's kind of what they do.
Yeah,
isn't it? It seems like they find people, they give them something, and then they send them in their stead instead of.
Well, no, she had a life. She had a daughter. She raised her daughter and then the grandson. And she was teaching this coterie of usually old Bengali ladies, you know, but other people as well. But she was so simple.
Right.
You know, like we went with a friend once whose mother was insane over the fact that he was in India and that he was practicing meditation, and she was just livid, and, you know, she wrote this vicious, horrible letter to him. And so he read it to Deepama, who reached under her mattress, which was like the bank, you know, and she was relatively pretty poor, but she reached under her mattress and pulled out all these rupee notes and handed them to him and said, "Go buy your mother a present from me," you know, and it was just so beautiful. Or, you know, you think about what she'd been through just as a human being, and she'd look at you and say, "Would you like some more tea? Can I get you some tea before your journey?" And,
wow.
And you think,
yeah, I see.
Boy, if I'd been through all that, would I even care if someone had enough tea? Yeah. You know, I don't know. Like,
but I love to think about this because, you know, we have created a spectrum here in a lot of different ways. We've talked about the spectrum of self. We've talked about the spectrum, an ethical spectrum. And now we're kind of talking about the spectrum of awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And you have met someone where you've seen this light emanating.
Yeah.
And, you know, here at this retreat, of course, Ram Dass talks about Neem Karoli Baba. And you think that there are these people living today, somewhere on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
There is an awake. You think there is a fully awakened being?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think very possibly.
That gives me goosebumps.
Yeah.
Because I think, well, what really are they up to? Because if they're fully awakened, they're participating.
Mm-hmm.
That's another quality. They participate.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't mean to get all, like, apocalyptic on you, but we see the ice caps are melting. The oceans are getting polluted. This isn't just, like, whining. There's strong data. Not only that, but every time I turn on the TV, it's something about North Korea and nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And there's this sense of an imminent happening. I don't know if you get that, but a lot of people I know are getting that feeling. When do these people come out of the caves to help?
Well, they're in the, I mean, this is obviously a lot of projection, but I think the ones who are in caves believe being in a cave is helping, you know, and they're not there because they're enjoying the dark, you know, like whatever it's like in a cave, you know, they're there because they believe that is helping.
How is that helping?
I mean, they're practicing unremittingly, or they're praying for all beings, or they're, you know, purifying their own minds. So there's a certain kind of energy they can deliver into the world that more ordinary people cannot, or whatever, you know. But not all of them are in caves by any means. A lot of people are teaching, and
some of them could be in cubicles. Some of them could be, you know, anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I just get the feeling they're there, and I find it interesting that you think that there is some kind of metaphysical, etheric field that they are putting their energy into that's making an actual change in the world.
It could have been worse than it is now, for all we know, you know. But, you know, I mean, it's so hard to say in terms of that apocalyptic vision, because they're also, you know, what's the time frame we're talking about? And I was with a friend the other day who was talking about a certain Tibetan worldview, you know, cosmology. And he was saying, you know, in some systems it's believed this is the Kali Yuga. This is the era of kind of destruction anyway. And even if this world blows up, there will be other world cycles. And, you know, life will get harder and harder and shorter and shorter. And then, you know, it'll sort of dissolve, and then the next one. So he was talking to this very kind of grounded attorney. And You know, and he's saying, you know, by, you know, in 3 million years or something, it'll all turn around again. And this guy looked at him like, yeah, you know, like, I'm not waiting, you know, like.
Right. You're not waiting.
No, I mean, but, you know, most people aren't waiting, but you can also act with a whole other vision of, like, big, big, big time and space, because we don't know, right? We're operating in this vast unknown. You think you did something and nothing came of it, and maybe 10 years later you find, oh, look at that. That planted a seed, that comment I made to that person, they took it to heart later. Yeah. Not at the time, but later. And they really reflected on it, and they changed their life.
What, now, I want to ask you about that, because that's another of the qualities, is they plant seeds in you, and then you're walking down the street, and then you're like, wait.
That's right.
Wait, I need to see them again. Wait, shit.
Yeah.
They're gone now. Yeah. What, is, that's an intentional thing, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's intentional. So I was once, I was standing with Krishnadas. We were in Tucson, we were staying in the same hotel, and the same hotel the Dalai Lama was staying in, because he was they had a sort of way they like to do things, which they like to turn these hotels into ashrams, and so he'd teach in the same hotel he was staying in, and then people from out of town would try to stay in that same hotel, because we'd kind of all be together. So it was the morning the Dalai Lama was leaving, and we just somehow got a hint that he was leaving through this back door, and so maybe there were 20 of us standing by that door, and sure enough, he comes down some elevator, and
I'm sorry, who comes down?
The Dalai Lama.
Okay.
And, you know, and he comes down.
What did you call him?
The Dalai Lama.
Oh, I thought you said something different.
No, no, no. I must be muttering.
No, I just realized I have earbuds in my ears for no reason.
So he goes around, he like blesses everybody in the circle as we're, you know, waiting to say goodbye to him. He gets to the door. He turns around, the Dalai Lama, and he says something. And then he walks out the door. So Krishnadas said something to me like, did you hear him say practice well? And I said, no, that's not what he said. I heard him say something or other. And no one catching, because this Tibetan flute player was there. And he said, did you hear him say some other whole thing? And I said, no, that's not what I heard. That's not what Krishnadas heard. Every single one of us heard a different thing.
Wow.
You know, so what did he actually say? Who knows? Maybe he said 20 things.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. You are teaching a lot of us, Sharon, and you have this wonderful book coming out. It's coming out in just the nick of time. Can you tell people where they can find it? And is it on pre-sale right now?
Yeah, it's on pre-sale right now. It's coming out June 6th, but it's already available like on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all kinds of outlets.
And this book, now, I think a lot of people don't realize that buying something, I mean, so, you know, I in fact didn't really realize this until Lily was talking about how, like, this actually, if you get it on pre-sale, it's a huge help, right?
Yeah, it's a huge help. It's so, I mean, I don't understand the system either, and it's always changing, but apparently books that are sold during pre-sale are kind of spark the whole system, you know, so bookstores will order more, and, you know, it's just considered to be very, very valuable, which I always thought was odd. It's not enough to sell the book. You have to pre-sell the book.
Yeah, I've always thought that. I had no idea, but it does make sense. It's a metric.
Yeah, it's a metric.
So basically, so friends, listen, where is it? On your website?
It's on my website, which is SharonSalzberg.com. There's a whole page of various options to buy it now.
Okay, cool. So just get a pre-sale. If you're going to get the book and you want to chip in, here is someone who's not in a cave. They're doing book tours. So get the book pre-sale. It's worth it. You can hear the energy coming from her. You get it, friends. Sharon, I love you. Thank you so much. And I can't wait to hear more of your teachings tomorrow.
Thank you. I love you.
Hare Krishna. Thank you. That was Sharon Salzberg, everybody. Pre-order a book. Go to SharonSalzberg.com. Click on the store. The link will be at DuncanTrussell.com. in the comments section. Much thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode. If you need a new website or you want to revise your old one, go to squarespace.com. Use offer code Duncan. You'll get 10% off your first purchase. Sign up for a year. You get a free domain name. If you enjoy this podcast, why not give us a nice rating on iTunes? Subscribe to us. Use our Amazon link. But most importantly, spread the love, beat the drums, let it happen, friends. Wonderful things are coming down the pipe. I'll see you next week. Hare Krishna.